two announcements. There's two more talks coming in this session, and the one which is coming tomorrow night is probably going to be one of the most interesting ones on reincarnation, and including stories about ghosts and devas. So not only will there be many people here tomorrow night, there will also be many ghosts and devas here too. So it should be a packed hall tomorrow night. So if you want to get your seat early, please come early tomorrow, otherwise the ghosts and the devas will be full, taking all the seats. And the final talk would be on Saturday night, and that's laughing all the way to Nirvana. So just to emphasize the happiness aspect and the joyful aspect of Buddhist life. So the last people are coming in, it's just gone past 8 o'clock now, so shall we start? Okay. Any more announcements or just go? Okay, so here we go. The talk this evening is on enlightenment. And it is very important that you get some idea of what enlightenment is, because otherwise people will ask you, your friends, what's the goal of Buddhism? And you say enlightenment, and they say, what does that mean? You say, you don't really know. And to begin the talk, I'm going to tell a story, again, from my own spiritual journey, you know, starting as a young schoolboy and becoming interested in religion, even when I was only about 15 or 16. And at that time, because I was at a school in London, and the school was a very good school, I got a scholarship to that school. It wasn't a public school, it was a direct grant school. In other words, if you were smart kids from the ordinary schools, the government would give you a scholarship to study there. And actually there was quite a few famous people who went to that school. Perhaps the most famous person that... Actually, there's two famous people that you would probably know who went to that school. Both actors. One is Hugh Grant. He went to that school. So the next time I see him at a school reunion, I'll ask him to come to give a talk at Shen Parker Buddhist Lodge. I'm sure if Hugh Grant came in here, you'd probably get more people than even when Ajahn Brahm gives a talk. And the other one, just for interest, for those of you who watched the comedy series Fawlty Towers, did you watch that British comedy series Fawlty Towers? Well, one of the stars in that series was the waiter, Manuel, who was supposed to be from Barcelona, but he was one of my classmates, Andy Sachs, and he wasn't from Barcelona, he was from Chiswick in England. But anyhow, when I was at school, becoming interested in religion, one day I went up to the chaplain, we had our own Anglican chaplain in that school, and asked him, what is God? Now what does it mean, the idea of a God? Because many people, the modern Christians anyway, have long ago moved away from an old man with a white beard living in the clouds. And he told me that it's very hard to describe what God is. It's transcendent, beyond words, ineffable. You may sound it's like the ground of all being, the beginning and end of all things. He said, yes, that's what God is. And I said, what does that mean? And what he said didn't make any sense to me at all. And that was just an example of people could not give me a clear, rational description of this ultimate goal in some religions of a God. So later on, when I became a Buddhist, I started asking some monks. Now these are supposed to be experts. They say, Nibbana, enlightenment. What's enlightenment? And they told me it's very hard to describe. It's transcendent. It's beyond words. The beginning and end of all things. Ineffable. And I thought, I've heard that before somewhere. And even some monks And nuns and teachers have a hard time explaining what enlightenment is. And I often quote the great scientist Werner Heisenberg. He was one of the founders of quantum theory, and you may all know him, even ordinary people know him, for his Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And he once said, if you really understand what you're talking about, such as even quantum physics, he said you can even explain it to the barmaid serving in the pub. And I think he really meant that. When you understand what you're talking about, you do find it easy to make good explanations. So really, that some people should be able to explain enlightenment to you in words which you can understand. Otherwise, when we don't know what it is, sometimes we can get very, very confused. When you become a Buddhist, it's like I say getting on an aircraft. Now, the Buddha Airways. And you're not really quite clear what the destination is. You're going to Nirvana, but you don't really know if you really want to go there. For example, there was one of my disciples who went to a meditation retreat center in Sri Lanka many years ago. And it was a very powerful meditation technique which he was following. And one day he rang his wife at home in Perth from Sri Lanka, saying, great news, darling. My meditation has gone so well, my teacher has confirmed I'm a stream winner. And oh, the wife was so impressed. Now that's the first stage of enlightenment. Oh, well done. And a couple of weeks later, he rang again. Teacher's confirmed. I'm now a once returner. That's the second stage of enlightenment. And again, she was astounded he could make such great progress so quickly. But when the third telephone call came, where he announced he was now a non-returner, his wife got very worried. He said, that's enough, come home, because I want you to go back to work to pay off our mortgage, our home loan. Because once you take the next step to be fully enlightened, you can't go back to the world anymore. You become a monk or you die, according to the tradition. And she didn't want her husband to die because he would leave her in a great amount of debt. So please don't get enlightened. It turned out to be sham enlightenment after all. But nevertheless, when people don't know what enlightenment is, they can get into some very strange and difficult situations. So, what is enlightenment? In terms which everybody can understand. And some of you have heard this description before, but it is a very beautiful and meaningful and easy to understand explanation of the meaning of enlightenment in the Buddhist context. But not only does it explain what it is, it also explains how to become enlightened. Which is why it is a very beautiful simile. And it's a simile of the children playing the wishing game. The simile of the children playing a wishing game goes like this. Five children had a game. And the game was that you would each have a wish, and the child with the best wish would win the wishing game. So when they asked the first child, maybe only 7 years of age, if you had a wish, what would it be? And then he said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a Big Mac with double fries. Because his mother would never allow him to have a McDonald's hamburger. And that was his wish. Very good. What is the second girl's wish? And the second girl had time to hear the first wish, and she very easily got a much better wish. She said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a McDonald's restaurant. Then I could have as many hamburgers as I want, whenever I want them. That was obviously a superior wish, and the second girl was winning. Then they asked the third boy, if you had a wish, what would it be? And the third boy was very smart. He said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion. US, not Australian. Because with $1 billion US, he said, I can buy my own McDonald's restaurant. And I will also be able to buy my own video game store. So I can have as many video games as I want. However, my mother always tells me off that I'm playing too many video games and not doing my homework. So the next thing I'll buy will be my own school. When I buy my own school, then I can give myself top marks and never need to go. Any teacher who gives me homework, I'll sack them, I'll fire them. And after graduating from my own school, I'll sell the school and buy a university. And that way, $1 billion is more than enough to last me throughout my whole life.
So it was a boy with a $1 billion wish.
Now it was a very hard wish to beat. Because even if you said $2 billion or $3 billion, that wouldn't really be superior than the $1 billion wish, because $1 billion or $2 billion, you still have plenty of money left at the end of your life. So the fourth child was very hard pressed to think of a wish which would surpass the $1 billion wish. But she was a very, very clever girl. She thought and said, if I had a wish, my wish would be for 3 wishes. That's a wish. That counts. For my first wish, I'll have a McDonald's restaurant. For my second wish, I'll have $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. Now that was a girl who had an infinity of wishes. Now can you beat that? The last child managed to formulate a wish which was far superior than an infinity of wishes. This little boy said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. I wish I was so content, I never need any more wishes. And they all agreed that that boy won the wishing game. That is what we call enlightenment. Nibbana. Being so content, you want for nothing. That you have no more wishes, because you're fully content, perfectly at ease, no matter what happens. In the usual way of describing this, we say the end of craving. Now you understand what it means. Because the fourth person's wish, the fourth girl's wish, an infinity of wishes, that's what most people think is the reason or the cause of happiness in our world. We want to have the freedom of desires. So we can do whatever we want, go wherever we want, get whatever we want, whenever we want it. We work very hard to have such freedoms. And our government tries to give us such freedoms. And we celebrate such freedoms. We call that the freedom of desire. But those of you who follow such freedoms, those of you who are wealthy, or know other people who are wealthy, who can buy whatever they want, go wherever they want, whenever they want it, are they happy? You'll find, quite surprisingly, that the very wealthy people are not particularly happy. They have the freedom of desires, but they never have the freedom from desires, which is symbolized by the fifth child being so content they don't want any more things. They have no more wishes. Being so content they never need any more wishes. That's called a freedom from desire. And to emphasize that, a story from my life as a Buddhist monk. As many of you should know, that I'm a monk from the forest tradition in northeast Thailand, and we keep our precepts very strictly. One of which is we don't accept any money. Any of the donations anyone has given here get collected and sent to my monastery. Actually, from here it's going to the retreat center fund, but nothing to me. I don't need anything. Those of you who will visit my monastery, if you are lucky, will take you to see where I live. My hut is a cave, a monk-made cave, and it's very small and there's nothing there. It's very simple, because this is what a monk is supposed to be. We love simplicity, so I don't need any money. However, there is a special allowance which the Buddha established even for strict monks. The allowance is that you can come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you have helped me so much, is there anything you need? You can actually ask me if I want something. And very often in Thailand they will say the amount. So I have, say, no, 50 ringgit. What would you like for 50 ringgit? Now please do not do this to me, because this is what happened when I first experienced this. As a young monk in Thailand, I'd help somebody, giving them some counseling. They really appreciated what I had done. And so they came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you've helped me, I want to help you. Is there anything, any personal requisites you want? And I have 100 Thai baht for you. That's worth, what is it, roughly about 10 ringgit or something? I have 100, this was many years ago. And when he asked me, is anything you want? I had to think for a while, because I was actually quite content. I started thinking, and being a lay person, he was very busy. He said, come on, make up your mind. I said, it's hard to think. I know what. I will go back to my hut and I'll think about it tonight, and in the morning I'll give you a list. Come back tomorrow. He said, great, that's a very good idea. I'll meet you tomorrow, and whatever you want for 100 baht, I'll take the list and I'll get it for you. I can't accept the money, but I can accept the offer. So I went back to my hut, and I got out a piece of paper. What do I need for 100 baht? And I started thinking, actually, a couple of aerograms would be good, so I can write a letter to my family and friends back in England. But you know, I also need like a pen, because my pen is running out. And actually, my sandals are also very worn out. I could also, you know, I can use a little tape recorder, because we have all these recordings of Ajahn Chah. That would be very useful. And I could also use, you know, a little hat, because it gets very cold in the forest. And I started filling out a list. And soon I realized that 100 baht wasn't enough. And I thought, what can I take off the list? And actually I couldn't take anything off the list. It was really important. I was quite happy beforehand. Now each of those items was absolutely necessary. And I started actually adding more items on. I couldn't take anything off. And soon, 1,000 baht wasn't enough. 10,000 baht wasn't enough. The longer I went, the more things I absolutely needed. And then I realized what's going on. I screwed up that piece of paper, threw it away. And when the man came the following day, I said, give it to anything. Take that 100 baht and burn it, but don't do that to me ever again. Before I had the offer, I did want for nothing. I was very content. But now, that opportunity was open to me. No matter how much money, it was never enough. This is a problem. When you have desires, there is no end to those desires. The infinity of wishes has never got a termination. But the last child who said, I wish I was so content, I never needed any more wishes. That was what enlightenment is. So content. So how do you become enlightened? Look at your wife. Are you happy with her? Or do you want to change her for somebody else? For those girls who aren't married yet, do you really want a husband, a partner to share your life with? Many years ago, two sisters came for counseling. I think many of you know this story, it's a wonderful story. Two Thai sisters came for counseling. And I talked to the first, the eldest sister, to begin with. What's your problem? Her problem was her husband. She was having a terrible time with her husband, and she even thought her husband might be seeing another woman. You know what it's like? She couldn't be sure, but she was very suspicious. And her husband was never kind to her, always asking for too much, never giving her enough money. It was a terrible relationship she had, and she was really considering getting rid of her husband. And she came to ask me for advice. The usual advice I give is actually to try and work it through, you know, because don't give it up. But anyway, that was her problem. She wanted to get rid of her husband. So I tried the best, but then her sister was waiting patiently, so I had to turn to her sister. I said, "What's your problem?" She said, "My problem is I'm single. I've been going out with all these men, but maybe only for 1 month or 2 months, and then it doesn't work out. I just can't get a husband. I can't get a relationship. That's my problem." She wanted a husband. She couldn't find one. Her sister had a husband she didn't want. So I thought of a solution. It was very logical and reasonable. They were sisters after all. They could share. Her big sister had a husband she didn't want. Her younger sister wanted a husband. There you go, swap. But they would not buy it. Of course, it was only a joke, but then I told them the important part of the story. I looked at the elder sister and said, "You, madam, have got what in Buddhism we call husband suffering." And I've counseled many wives, and they all have the same problem. It's endemic, it's par for the course. It's called husband dukkha. Dukkha is the word for suffering. So those of you having a hard time with your partner, it's called husband suffering. And I told her, if you get rid of your husband, and if you separate, divorce, you won't have husband suffering anymore. You'll have what your sister has. Single, lonely woman suffering. And it's the same with you, single woman. If you find a partner, you won't have single woman suffering anymore. You will have husband suffering. And it's the same with you girls as well. If you're single, you think, "Oh, if I only could find somebody." Or if you young boys, "If I could only find my soulmate." You don't have single woman suffering anymore, or single man suffering. You have married people suffering. It's the same. I remember this when I was at school. I couldn't wait to finish school and finish university and get a job and be free of school. And it was true. As soon as I finished school and university, I never had school suffering anymore or university suffering. You know, you have what everyone recognized, having to get up on a Monday morning, fight through the traffic and get to a job and get to an office. You have workers suffering. And for those of you who are now working, and you think, "Oh, if only I can retire." Have a look at those people who have retired. When you retire, you don't get working suffering anymore. You get retiree suffering. That's all you get. And I mention that story to people who come up to me and say they want to renounce. They want to become a monk. They want to become a nun. I say, "Why do you want to become a monk or a nun?" "Oh, because life is so much suffering. Oh, it's so difficult." And I say, "Madam, sir, you have what we call lay people suffering. Once you become a monk or a nun, you won't have that suffering anymore. You will have what I have, monk suffering." I have to get up really early in the morning and teach retreats and give counseling and talk about people come up to me and talk about their marriage problems and their children problems. And you know, I became a monk to get out of all of that. But I am compassionate. One very important piece of advice for those of you who do counseling, or you see me when you come to the interviews, you yogis, and as soon as I talk to you, there's another one outside with another problem. My teacher, a very wise man, said that whenever you do counseling, you have to be like a dustbin. A counselor is like a dustbin. You sit there and people dump all their rubbish on you. Their marriage, their family, their finances, their health, their kids, their family. And they dump all of that on you. And you have to compassionately accept it. So you have to be a very big dustbin. But, my teacher said, the trick, the skill of being an effective counselor is to be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So you accept everything, but you keep nothing. So it all comes in, you accept it, and it goes out the other end, just like your food, but much quicker. And it means that after one person has left, you're already open and empty to receive the next person's problems. So those of you who do counselling, that was such a help to me, to be a dustbin, so you never keep anything. You never keep the problems of other people, but you accept and listen to them with compassion and openness, and then you let them go. Like a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So when you understand about where many people think they will have happiness in life, wishing for something more, wishing for something better. Sometimes I wish my husband would only be just a little bit more sensitive. Let me tell you a secret about husbands. They are all the same. If you think if you swap and get a better model, they're not exactly the same model. Like proton cars, all the same model, same engine inside. Even sometimes you'd say, well, I don't want, say, a Malaysian. Maybe I'll get a Westerner next time, an Ang Mo husband. I think it's true, isn't it? The proton car has got a Honda engine. Is it Toyota? Mitsubishi engine. Okay, so it may look Malaysian, but it's got a Japanese engine inside. So it doesn't matter whether they are born in the West or they're born in Asia, they're all the same engine inside. And the same with your wives. Okay, I mean, you think that maybe she's not as pretty as Angelina Jolie. Especially when she's 50. But look, she's good enough. Now this is what we mean by contentment. Contentment is being happy with the person you are and happy with the person you're with. And what a wonderful thing that is to encourage in our society. There's too much discontent, especially with our family members. You know, we want our wife to be the best. We want our husband to do well in his career and be the richest. We want our kids to do well at school. And as I said to the youth group yesterday, if your child comes in the top 5% at school, they're not a good Buddhist. If they come in the bottom 5%, they're not a good Buddhist. How many of you Buddhists have heard of the middle way? They should be in the middle somewhere. And if they're in the middle, they're a good Buddhist. That's only a bit of funny games, but the children yesterday, we were talking about what worries them. Some of them were doing their O-levels. Others were doing their A-levels. And I said, what you should really be studying hard for, and what your children should be giving you extra tuition for, is your hate levels, your happiness levels. Because life really is about happiness. And I said the other day, happy people get successful, not the other way around. So encourage your children to don't worry too much about your O levels or your A levels, but really do well in your hate levels, your happiness level examinations in life. So, when we learn about a little bit about contentment, we're getting close to the idea of what enlightenment is. We work very, 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 very hard, but there must come a time when we think, okay, this is good enough for me. That we can end our wishes and relax and let go. Many of you want to retire to get enough to look after yourself and your family, and maybe to do some Dharma work. But look at me. I retired when I was 23. And had a great life afterwards, serving or whatever. So what enlightenment is like learning how to be content. It's the end of wishes, the end of desires. But that's only one description of enlightenment. The other one, which I really, really like, which is nothing like ineffable or the ground of all being or any stuff like that. The other part of enlightenment, which I really, really like, which is so accurate, the Buddha called, and this is straight from Dhammapada, it's in the sutras as well, Nibbanaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ. Nibbana, enlightenment, is the ultimate happiness. Now that was also very important for me when I started looking for teachers. Because I wanted a teacher who knew what they were talking about. So not someone who could describe what enlightenment was, I wanted someone who was living enlightenment. So I went around looking for the monks or the nuns who were expressing the ultimate happiness. And that's why I was inspired by monks like Ajahn Chah, because he was very, very happy, but very content. The other day someone asked me a question here, did I think Ajahn Chah was enlightened? And I did say yes, because I lived with him for 9 years. And it wasn't because he gave very inspiring teachings. That didn't convince me. One of the events which really convinced me was this. About 1 or 2 years before I left for Australia, when I'd been with him for 7 or 8 years, so I was getting quite reasonably senior for a disciple, because usually the senior monks would actually go off and start their own monasteries. So by that time I was getting reasonably seen, and obviously knew my teacher very well by now. And one day when I was looking after him under his hut, he asked me to go up to his room to get something. Now normally he would never allow anybody into his own personal room. And I'd always wanted to see inside his room what he had, to check out my teacher. Now by this time, Ajahn Chah was very, very famous. He was invited to the palace, you know, the king was listening to his Dharma talks, and the queen, generals, prime ministers were coming up to seek advice from him. And especially, even in those days, even more in those days, the army was very powerful, and so generals would come up also to seek advice. And when they did, they would obviously leave gifts, donations. So you'd expect this monk would be very, very wealthy. He certainly would have access to whatever he needed, whatever he wanted. But when I went up to his room and opened the door, I even can visualize it now. His quarters, where he lived, was so empty. All there was a grass mat, a wooden pillow, and on the line, a bamboo rod, was one spare robe. And nothing else was in his hut. When I saw that, I realized this monk who could have everything decided to have nothing at all. That's a sign of an enlightened being, who's so content they don't need anything. You're free. Free of the burden of possessions. Free of attachments. Isn't that supposed to be what we're enlightened being is supposed to get rid of? All attachments. Do you know that Buddhist joke in the West? Why is it that in Buddhist houses in United States you will always find dust and dirt in the corners? It is because their vacuum cleaners don't have any attachments. But anyhow, that's a good Buddhist joke. It's actually a sign that Buddhism is taking off in the West, when you get Buddhist humour. But it's that peace and freedom which is so important. So sometimes maybe you're not ready to live like an Ajahn Chah, but sometimes we look upon our lives and think, now how much do we really need to be happy? And this is an important teaching for our modern age, because we all know about the problems of global warming. We all know about the problems facing our future. Now one of the problems is overpopulation. And my solution is to have more monks and nuns. At least I'm doing my part for overpopulation. But one of the solutions there is for everybody in our world to learn how to live more simply. And how can we live more simply? It is by sharing more. Too often resources which we have in the world are left unused because we won't share. Too often, especially in places like the West, people have these huge houses. As a monk, sometimes I go to these houses to do ceremonies, blessing ceremonies. And once I went to this riverside mansion in Perth to do a blessing for a Thai woman who just moved into this huge house. And because I travelled an hour away where my monastery was, the first thing I did when I went into her house was to ask to go to the toilet. This is no joke. She had to draw me a map of how to go to the toilet in her house. But unfortunately, she lived in the house alone. I don't know how many bedrooms, 10 bedrooms or something. And she lived in there alone. I've known that with many wealthy people. The more they have, it seems, the more lonely they get. So I remember my house when I grew up. It was a small apartment. I had to share a room with my brother. And it was only such a small apartment, we were always bumping into each other. Which meant we learned how to love each other and get on together. My father said that when he grew up, all his brothers and sisters had to sleep in the same bed. You know sometimes how it might have been like when you talk about, you know, the old days? That's when they really had to get on with each other. Unfortunately, when we all have our own rooms, when we have a big house, we don't need to meet each other so often. I saw a cartoon in the paper before I left. The modern couple had grounded their child, they sent him to his room. And when they went to check up on him, there he was, playing with his computer, listening to his iPod, having a great time, having DVDs downloaded from the internet. And they said, sending your child to his room is not what it used to be in the old days. Unfortunately, sometimes the wealth we have means we sacrifice the contentment of our family values, of being around each other, getting to know each other, talking to each other and loving each other. I still remember from the first year in Northeast Thailand, this was 1974 or something, going to a ceremony in the village one evening. And as I walked into that village, there was no electricity. So because of no electricity, there was no TVs. There was no radios. And in that village, just like the old houses in the kampongs of Malaysia, they always had to be built on stilts to prevent, to avoid the floods which always come in this part of the world. And the upstairs area would be open. And as I passed house after house after house after house, I saw the same scene. A semicircle of people. From the old people, the old grandparents, uncles and aunties, mothers and fathers, sisters, children, all sitting around a simple oil lamp, talking to each other, telling stories, laughing at silly jokes. They'd have probably heard those stories many times, but they always enjoyed hearing them once more, and sharing every evening together, talking with one another. When I saw that, I thought, in my house, even though it was poor, we lost out because we had a TV. If we were only a little bit poorer, we'd have loved each other more deeply. That was a signal to me of some of the dangers of wealth. The more wealthy we are, the more lonely we become. Because we don't need to spend time with each other anymore. We haven't got the time to spend. So, a little bit of simplicity makes us more wealthy in time. It gives us a closer connection with each other. And so, contentment and simplicity are a very important spiritual way of actually helping secure the future of our planet. But nevertheless, let's go back to enlightenment. Because when a person gets more and more content, more and more happy, more and more peaceful, more and more simple, they get closer to becoming enlightened. And being enlightened means, you know, you have enough inner happiness, enough contentment, enough love, you don't need so much to live in this world. So even monks, now, because we don't accept money in Australia, it's really good fun whenever I have to go to some government body. Because sometimes, even for a passport, you have to prove who you are. And you have to get ID. And so the government people ask you for your bank account details. And I say, we don't have bank account details. Oh, that's a problem. Give me your car license, your driving license. Monks don't have driving license, so I can't drive. We're not supposed to drive. Okay, let me see your marriage certificate. One time they asked to see that. And all of the things which... what about your tax? In Australia we call it a tax number. So your tax ID number. Haven't got that either. Social Security number? No. It's wonderful in Australia, even though I'm Australian, I don't exist on the records. I'm just too weird. But, nevertheless, it's wonderful to live that simply. And sometimes people ask, well, what do you do that for? And it's a powerful statement that today we it's a wonderful statement in today's world we can have people living like this, like monks, with no money, with no assets, with no security for their future. You know what my security for my future is? Sometimes people ask me, when you go to Malaysia, do you get travel insurance? Of course I don't. My insurance is my good karma. Because if I get sick, I'm sure there's many doctors here who would actually fight a battle to look after me. Even once when I was visiting prison, When I was visiting this top security jail one day, the prison officers took me aside when I first went in, because the previous couple of weeks there had been some very serious assaults on the volunteers, like me. Now these were prisoners who were in jail for long periods of time. They had nothing to lose. Many of them knew they would die in jail. So if there was any visitor they didn't like, they'd very often rape them. Homosexual rape. And there was plenty had been raped and assaulted that last fortnight that they had to have special security measures. They gave me a little, what looked like a ballpoint pen. But they said, this isn't a pen, although it's got a writing implement at the bottom. It is a new security alarm. They said, on the ceilings you will notice what looks like smoke detectors, but they're not smoke detectors, they are security detector alarms. If you get attacked, point the pen at one of those alarms, press the top, the alarm will go off, and also we know exactly where you are, we'll come and save you. But they said, don't tell any of the prisoners, this is secret top security. So when I went into my meditation group, because they said put it in your jacket, I said, look at me, I haven't got jackets, I just hold it in your hand. So I held it in my hand. When I got into my meditation group, the first thing my prisoner said, oh, you've got one of those security alarms too. And then one of the prisoners, one of the big guys, looked me straight in the eye and said, Ajahn Brahm, do you think you could even press that button before I jumped you? And I looked at him and I said, probably not. And he said, no, you couldn't. I could get to you and rape you before you even thought of it. And I knew he was telling the truth. These guys are fast and tough. They're career criminals. They're tough guys. But then he smiled at me and he said, you don't have to worry, Ajahn Brahm. We like you. If any of the guys behind me tried that, I'd get them first. It was my good karma, was my insurance policy in that jail. Which is why, when you look at your security for the future, which is why many of you are working so hard, why not think of like good karma, compassion and kindness, as your investment for your future? Because if you're kind and compassionate, caring and generous, you have so many friends. And it's your friends will look after you, not the insurance company, in your old age or in your infirmity. That's the best insurance policy for your future. Your kindness, your generosity, your friendship, that is what will keep you warm and comfortable in your old age or whenever you become sick. So, learning how to be enlightened is actually common sense. Learning the values, learning a bit of contentment and happiness. Being content with your job, being content with your partner, being content with your children, and sometimes being content with your lot in life. Of course you should try and work hard to sort of make a better world, but don't make it the most important thing in your life. Make the happiness the most important thing. Isn't that really what a home is all about? A real home, and my teacher mentioned this many, many times, a real home should be a place you come to relax from the stresses and the struggles of life. Unfortunately, people work so hard at work, and they come home and they work hard at home. There's office politics and there's home politics. There's arguments when you're working and arguments when you get home. Unfortunately, that's not a real home. A real home is a place where everyone can come back and relax. So please, have time for work and time for contentment. And if you build a house of contentment, you have a wonderful mansion, a real mansion. Not a big house, but a happy house. And so going for happiness and making more and more happiness is one of the great paths to enlightenment. But how enlightenment actually happens is eventually one actually sees these truths. One understands them through insights about, you know, the way to peace, the way to contentment, the way to happiness. You can't just understand them because a monk comes and tells them. Because as I said, I've been coming to Malaysia for about 7 or 8 years now. And some of you have been coming to my talks from the very first, and still you're not enlightened. Oh my goodness. But really, it's listening is not how you become enlightened. You listen, and then you learn, and then you practice what you hear. And what inspires me is little by little, people do listen, they do understand, and they understand a little, and their lives become so much more peaceful, and so much more simple, and so more happy. Because you're seeing the truth of the secret of happiness. In the sutras, the Buddha called it like the simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. This is a Buddhist simile, and I noticed that it was one of the famous teachings of Buddhism for the present king of Thailand, because he had a mural painted of the seven shipwrecked sailors. And it helps us understand not what enlightenment is so much as the way to become enlightened. The seven shipwrecked sailors simile goes like this. Seven sailors were shipwrecked, and there they were in the ocean, a long way from land. And the first sailor went straight down and drowned almost immediately. The second sailor was floating on the surface for a while, and then he went down and drowned. The third sailor managed to float on the surface. He'd keep his head above water. The fourth shipwrecked sailor, keeping his head above water, looked around and saw the shore, saw dry land. The fifth shipwrecked sailor, he had floated, seen dry land, and now was swimming towards that dry land. The sixth shipwrecked sailor had swum so far he could actually stand up in the surf, he was wading to shore. And the last shipwrecked sailor had floated, seen the land, swam, waded, and now he was on the dry land. He was safe. And when the Buddha gave that simile, he explained it. The first shipwrecked sailor was the one who'd done bad karma. You go straight down. The second shipwrecked sailor was the ordinary person, the average Joe or Joanne. The person who's done some good and some bad. But they can't really keep their head above water. The third shipwrecked sailor was a virtuous person. The one who was kind, forgiving, generous, compassionate, who'd helped in society, who'd done their share. And they always managed to keep their head above water in the difficult times of life. It's the virtuous ones are the survivors. A lot of times because they have a great circle of family and friends to look after them in times of difficulty. So the virtuous one is the one who floated. And the fourth one, again, a virtuous one who looked around and saw the meaning of life, freedom, the truth. In Buddhism we call it Dhamma. That's called the stream winner. The one who actually understands, you know, what the Buddha saw, the Dhamma, the truth, freedom. And the next one is the one who's swimming towards shore. It's always the case, once you understand the meaning of life, the truth, you understand it first, and then you start doing something about it. You have to, you can't avoid that. Just like if you see the shore, and you're in the middle of the ocean, you have to start swimming. And the sixth, that's the once returner. The next shipwrecked sailor, the one who's standing in the surf, wading to shore, that's called the non-returner, the anagami, who's so close to enlightenment, it doesn't really make that much difference. They're actually standing in the surf, wading to shore. And the last one, who is completely safe, that's the completely enlightened one, the Arahat. So, the path to enlightenment for each one of us is actually seeing the truth of things, understanding the meaning of life, where happiness truly lies, what's contentment, and how you can work hard and still be content. Because a lot of times people misunderstand. They think, oh, if you're supposed to be content, does that mean I must sleep in bed every morning? Ajahn Brahm said, let go, no desire. So I'm in bed, let go, no desire. Don't need to go to work, I'm content. That's obviously not what we mean. Right, we understand what we mean here, and understand this is a path of happiness. You understand, then once you understand it, you start practicing it. Once you understand why people are generous, because it makes them happy, why they're kind, because it makes them happy, why they're peaceful, because it makes them happy, when you understand what happiness is, obviously you'll swim in that direction, you'll become happier people, and eventually get so close to happiness, you're the non-returner, and eventually you're just sitting or standing on dry land, you're the completely happy person. And that's how we know if someone is enlightened or not. Because that's the other question which people often ask about enlightenment. How do you know who is enlightened or not? I think yesterday or the day before, someone asked the question, is Sai Baba enlightened? Have you supposed to be a Buddhist to be enlightened? And, you know, is people from other religions, can they not be enlightened? People ask all these questions, but how you know if someone is enlightened or not is to see whether they still have any craving, any desire. Or in particular, if they have got any anger and ill will. Because angry people are not enlightened. And that's usually the way we find out, as the following story will tell you. Again, this is a favorite story of enlightenment. Many years ago, there was a young monk in Japan. He was so keen on getting enlightened that after he'd finished his basic training as a monk, he went up to his abbot and said to him, now I know the basic rules of a monk and I've got the basic understanding of the sutras. Now I ask to go into solitude, to practice my meditation, to go all the way to enlightenment. I think I can do it. I have the will, I have the energy, I have the aspiration. I want to get enlightened. Please help. And the young monk said, not far from this monastery, there is a lake. In the middle of that lake is a very beautiful island on which no one lives. It would be simple for me to build a little monk's hut and live on that island until I become fully enlightened. But I would need an attendant just to row over once a week to leave me some supplies, just some simple rice and vegetables will be enough. Just once a week, that's all. And I can stay in solitude, in peace, meditating to become fully enlightened. And of course the abbot realized this monk's aspiration was a noble one and said, what a wonderful idea, I will arrange it. And after a short while, that monk was living in this isolated island in the middle of a lake, in a simple but beautiful hut, having no responsibilities and duties, perfectly alone in peace, meditating, going deep within, and finding out the meaning of life. After 3 years on that island, the young monk thought he was enlightened. And he contemplated how he could inform his abbot of his attainment. So one day when the attendant rode over to leave some supplies, the monk told the attendant, next week, can you please bring some parchment, some ink, and a pen? I want to write some calligraphy. So the next week the parchment, pen and ink came. And then the monk meditated for 3 days. And after the third day, when he came out of a deep meditation, he took out the parchment and he wrote in this beautiful calligraphy. You have to have such a clear, precise mind to write such calligraphy. Have you ever seen these masters of Chinese calligraphy at work? He wrote perfect characters in four lines. And the meaning was this, in English. The diligent monk was the first line. Alone for 3 years was the second line. Is no longer moved was the third line. By the four worldly winds was the last line. For anyone who knows the sutras of the Buddha and knows them well, that's one way of indicating you are perfectly enlightened. You're no longer moved by the worldly winds. You're as solid as a rock. No craving can move you. When he finished that calligraphy, he rolled it up, tied it with a ribbon, and waited for the attendant to come. He handed that scroll to the attendant and told him to give it to the abbot, which he did. And the young monk, now enlightened, started thinking of all the things which would happen once the abbot had read that scroll and understood there was one more enlightened monk in Japan. He thought that that scroll would probably be put in a big frame and hung in some famous temple. He thought that now he would probably get a temple of his own and be a teacher. He thought of all the people who would come listen to his talks and have great inspiration at his understanding of Dhamma. But the 1 week later, when the attendant came back, all the attendant did was give the scroll back to the monk. The monk was quite confused. Why is the abbot returning my scroll? And when he opened it, his amazement turned to anger. His eyes went wide like plates. Steam started coming out of his nose, and his lips started to quiver in anger and shock, because on that first line of beautiful calligraphy, the diligent monk, the abbot had written the four letters F-A-R-T, fart. And it wasn't particularly neat writing either, just in a red ballpoint pen. And the second line is no longer moved, this time in capital letters, F-A-R-T. Is no longer moved. The third line, another fart, this time underlined. And the fourth line, by the four worldly winds, and he'd written this huge F-A-R-T, underlined, 3 exclamation marks afterwards. That monk was incensed. How can that abbot not recognize enlightenment when it's in front of his fat old nose, a stupid old monk? He's not going to stand. And he just messed up this beautiful calligraphy, which took years to actually to compose. That could have been a work of art in the National Museum of Japan. And he's ruined it, this stupid old monk. He calls himself an abbot. What does he know about Buddhism or art or anything? He's a complete ignoramus, uncivilized, a fool, a buffoon. I'm not going to stand for this, said the young monk. And he caught the attendant and said, "Row me over. I'm going to face that abbot and tell him off." He was very angry. And so the attendant rowed him over very fast. And the young monk stormed into the abbot's room, slammed the paper, the parchment, on the table, and said, "Explain yourself, abbot." And the abbot, very calmly, took the scroll of paper, opened it up, and quietly read the monk's poem to him. The diligent monk alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And they looked at the young monk and said, "So, young monk, you're not moved by the four worldly winds, eh? Yet four little farts had blown you right over the lake." And that's a classic story of how you test someone who thinks they're enlightened. You try and make them angry. "You stupid disciple, you think you've got jhana and got enlightened? That's what I will tell you. And if you get angry, no, you're not." Because that happened to me. I will now tell you the story of when I got enlightened. Do you want to hear it? Actually, it's 9 o'clock, so maybe we'll leave it, shall we? No, shall we say it? You see, this is like showmanship. You always say, get people excited. It was my fourth year as a monk. I was in a very quiet monastery in the northeast of Thailand. It was the rains retreat. That period from July to October, where we don't do anything else, no ceremonies, no travel, we devote ourselves just to meditation. And I've been going very strongly in my meditation for many weeks. And one evening, I was doing walking meditation. My mind got very peaceful and very, very still. In those still states of mind, first of all, small insights started to come. And they built up into bigger and deeper understandings of the nature of reality. Oh, this is what happens when you talk about enlightenment. Mara gets into the microphone. And there's a... Mara, stop messing around. And these amazing insights started coming. And they came in a torrent, like a flood. Things I'd never understood before, but now were just so clear. And I was just so amazed at what I was seeing. And then finally the big one came. Wow. That was it. You could understand everything. And tears of joy came down. You just so much energy and peace and stillness. After all that time, this was it. Enlightenment. And I was walking on air. And it was late at night, maybe 12 o'clock or 1. You never felt like sleeping. Had so much energy and joy and peace and freedom. Oh, it was so nice. But I went back to my hut. Lay down, tried to sleep, couldn't. And so got up half an hour before the morning bell. In that monastery, 3 a.m. you had to get up. But I was sitting meditation by 2:30. Normally, because it's the tropics and because you didn't get much sleep and the food wasn't very good, you know, you did have sloth and torpor the first thing in the morning. But that morning, no sloth and torpor at all. Your back was perfectly straight, your mind was so poised. And it was so much fun to meditate. You know, all of you yogis, you know how hard it is sometimes? Sometimes you get it peaceful. But this was your best meditation multiplied by 10 all the time. It was just so nice being enlightened like that. And then after the chanting, we went on our duties, our arms round. And again, I was just so happy to give all these lay people an opportunity to give their dana to a new arahat. I was inspired. And then we came for our morning meal. Only ate one meal a day in those days, out of your bowl. And usually the food we got was the same every day. We had our bowl of sticky rice, glutinous rice. And with it we'd have a curry. And the curry was made of What in Thai they call pladek, which means rotten fish. What they would do, they would catch the fish in the paddy fields during the rainy season, and because they wouldn't have anything for the rest of the year, they would put them in a jar and preserve them for the rest of the year. Now, I used to be a vegetarian before I became a monk, but in Northeast Thailand in those days there were no vegetables. You see, you had to eat what everyone else ate. And to tell you how disgusting that rotten fish was, that one day in another monastery I was cleaning around the kitchen and I found a jar of this rotten fish. They usually just put the fish in these earthen jars and cover it with some plastic, but the plastic had broke, and so the flies had laid maggots in the rotten fish. And so this jar was seeded with maggots, so I went to throw it away. And the headman of the village, the most educated man in that region, saw me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, it's got maggots have got into it, I've got to throw it away." He said, "What do you mean throw it away? That is extra protein." So he took it from me. And like most days, the following morning we had rotten fish curry again. I was trying to find the maggots I'd seen the following day in the curry. It was disgusting. And it smelled disgusting. And even worse, it tasted disgusting. That's all you had to eat. You had to eat it, was rotten fish curry. And there was no vegetables in there. You know, usually there was, maybe a few forest roots, but nothing much. And that's what we ate every day. But I couldn't believe it. That morning, the morning of my enlightenment, there was another pot of curry. Someone had bought a pork curry. Now, if you're a vegetarian, you may think pork is not very nice, but actually, the pork was edible. It was actually tasty, not like the rotten fish curry. And straight away I thought, this is amazing. It must be that the heavenly beings, the devas, are celebrating my enlightenment by giving me a pot of pork curry today. I thought, how considerate of the heavenly beings. But in this monastery, you didn't help yourself. Well, you did help yourself. But first of all, the abbot, he would help himself first, pass the pot down. I was number two monk. Then he passed it to me, then I pass it to the next monk. We pass it down the line in order of our seniority to help ourselves. So when the abbot took his first share, you know, he's seen his big ladles. He took four whopping big ladles of this pork curry. And straight away I thought, the greedy pig. No one can eat four big ladles like that. It was too much for anybody. It was a huge amount. Even if you only eat one meal a day, that was too much. But I didn't mind because there was so much in there. And I was the next one in line. There'd be plenty left for me. So I didn't mind too much. But what he did next was just really just beyond what any civilized person would do. It was completely uncalled for, unwarranted, selfish, mean, despicable, everything. Because he was a local boy, a Thai, Northeast Thai monk, and he should have liked that rotten fish curry, but he never took any of that rotten fish curry himself. He just took four ladles of the pork curry, and then he lifted up the pork curry and poured it all in to the rotten fish curry, stirring it up and saying in Thai, "It's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway." What do you mean it's all the same anyway? If it was all the same, why did you take yours first and then mix it up? If you'd have mixed it up first and then taken it, fair enough. But it's not all the same. You're not just a pig, you're a hypocrite. And there was my beautiful pork curry, all spoiled by this rotten fish, this smelly, disgusting, tasteless rotten fish, and he spoiled my meal of the day. And I was so angry at that stupid abbot.
And then it hit me. I'm supposed to be enlightened. Oh no. You don't know what suffering is until you've been enlightened, then find out you're not. And at that, I didn't care what I ate. I just shoved a couple of spoonfuls into my bowl and passed it down. I was depressed. I realized I wasn't enlightened after all. So I wasn't really enlightened then. That was when I thought I was and found out because of anger that you weren't. So if you want to find out if any monk is enlightened, you can get some rotten fish curry and pour it all over my breakfast tomorrow morning. So that's actually how we find out what enlightenment is. And that's how enlightened. Enlightened people are very content and very peaceful and very kind and loving. They just don't get angry. And they don't need very much because they're content. People who have gone beyond all wishes. And enlightened people spend the rest of their lives just caring and helping other people. Not wanting anything for yourself means you have full freedom to care for others. So enlightened beings have got the most compassion in our world because all the energy of their lives is now going for other beings. Because they have disappeared and all they have is for others. So that's a talk about enlightenment. Obviously it's only scratching the surface, only talking a little bit about what enlightenment is and how it works and how you can recognize enlightened beings. But at least it gives you some indication of the path of enlightenment, contentment, happiness, and how you find out you're not enlightened. So thank you for listening to the talk today. Okay, we should have some questions coming soon if they're not already here. But any live questions from the audience? I know that one of the questions people ask is not just, you know, can you become enlightened in other religions? And the answer is obviously yes. Somebody once asked the Buddha that question, can you become enlightened in other religions? And they said, in any religion where you follow the path of enlightenment, of course you become enlightened. Also say, can girls become enlightened? Of course they can. Even homosexuals can become enlightened. So why not can girls and boys become enlightened too? But to be a homosexual and become enlightened, you have to give up your homosexuality. To be a man and become enlightened, you have to give up your masculinity. Are you going to give up something? Yeah, come on, what have you got today? Can we have the microphone live, please? You're coming. This is a question worth waiting for. Yes, it's me. Yes, I'm ready.
Anyway, on a more serious note, when a person, including a monk, becomes enlightened...
When a person, including a monk, becomes enlightened, yes?
What happens to his consciousness?
What happens to his consciousness? When you become enlightened, your consciousness becomes free.
So where does it go?
Because if you are caught in samsara,
yeah,
and you get reborn,
yeah,
your consciousness goes from one life to the next life, until you get liberated. Am I right?
Sort of, but not quite.
Then finally, when you are liberated, where does that consciousness go?
Where does the consciousness go? Before we answer the question, where does the consciousness go, we must know where it is right now. Where it's starting from. Now that this story, I think I said this last night, this was the story of One of my friend's daughters who was asked at primary school what's the biggest thing in the world. You remember that story? Did I say that last night?
No, you didn't say that.
I think it must have been in the morning talk. Yeah. What is the biggest thing in the world? She was asked as a grade 1 6-year-old child at a school in England. And one child said in the class, "My daddy is the biggest thing in the world." Another child said, "A mountain." Another one said, "An elephant." The daughter of my friend from college, from Cambridge, she said, "My eye is the biggest thing in the world." At which the teacher was stunned. "What do you mean the eye is the biggest thing in the world?" And this little 6-year-old genius said, "Well, my eye can see her daddy, my eye can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world." Now that's logic. She was seeing things in a different way. And when I heard that, I extended it to say, the mind is even bigger than the eye. Because your mind, your consciousness, can see everything your eye sees, and it can imagine things you'll never see in this world. It can hear real sounds and imaginary ones, it can feel. In fact, everything which can be known can fit into your mind. So it's not the mind goes anywhere, it's things come and go within the mind. So the perspective changes. The mind is a big thing. And you, me, the world come and go within the mind. So where does the mind go? It never goes anywhere.
Next question. Do animals have consciousness?
Do animals have consciousness? Yes, they do. Was it Coco the gorilla over in New York Zoo? Some smart psychologist taught him sign language. So this gorilla started talking. He had a conversation with the keepers. But what really convinced them that this gorilla had intelligence was when they caught on a camera without the gorilla noticing that the gorilla was talking to itself, making sign language to itself. Even more weird was Alex, the great African parrot who lives in St. Louis. Maybe some of you have seen the documentary about Alex, the great African parrot. Great African parrots live for many 60, 70, 80 years. And a psychologist who had trained in teaching intellectually retarded children language skills. So children who had difficulty learning language, there was a method to help them to learn languages. And she employed that on Alex the parrot. As you all know, that parrots can imitate human speech, but this parrot, they taught a whole vocabulary, and now that parrot uses the vocabulary intelligently. When I first saw this, and this wasn't some sort of animation done by Walt Disney or by Pixar or DreamWorks or something, this was real. You could have a conversation with this parrot, just as if you were talking to another human being. When you close your eyes, you'd think it was a human being talking, but it's a parrot. And what again convinced me, when during the conversation, the parrot turned around on its perch, walked away and said, "I'm bored."
Thank you, Ajit Brahm.
Yeah, that's okay, very good.
Short commercial. Yeah. Owners of the WLR 8885. Your car is blocking somebody. Thank you.
Okay. The car number?
WLR
8885. 8885. Your car is making bad karma. Okay, got another question. First question, when we practice Satipatthana, can we just practice one of four, or two of four, or must we practice all four? Satipatthana is using your mindfulness focus on the places where you think you exist, but you don't. That's a technical point, but as the Buddha said in the Anapanasati Sutta, anyone who practices Anapanasati fulfills all of the four Satipatthanas. So if you do the breath meditation, you are at the same time completing all four Satipatthanas. That's the word of the Buddha. The Ajahn, is Chan meditation Buddhist school similar with the other Buddhist meditation school? It certainly used to be, because Chan comes from jhana. Now the Sanskrit word jhana became Chan in China. So, it should be the same as what you're doing here. Which is why in our modern world, especially the teachings of Theravada and Mahayana, they're coming together. Many Mahayana monks and nuns are going back to the Agamas. The Agamas are the sutras, the early sutras of the Buddha. And we're finding that they're exactly the same as the teachings of Theravada. And it's just so easy to speak with each other, because we find we have the same roots. And this is actually a modern phenomena. Mahayana and Theravada are coming together. And it's wonderful to see. Ajahn Brahm, all these years some of us may have been brought up to believe that when we all die we go to heaven or hell. How can we be convinced that there is rebirth? Come tomorrow night and I will show you how you can find out. And it's an important thing to understand, because there are so many different religions, and in one religion there are so many different schools. And there are so many people say, only if you come to my church and believe in my teacher or my doctrine, only we go to heaven and all the rest of you losers go to hell. And some people get convinced. The people who shout the loudest, sometimes they're the ones you believe. And the only way to counter that is actually stop just believing who shouts the loudest or who has the best funded marketing campaign, and instead let's have some common sense, some reason, some investigation to actually find out which is the best product, what's true, what's not true. And the only way to find out is actually to investigate, to question, investigate. And tomorrow I'll be teaching you, encouraging you, how you can find out what hell is, what heaven is, and how you get there. And who is telling the truth, and who is deceived. Some people are like these people who sell you used cars, and they just paint them up to be a new car. So there's a lot of deceit sometimes in religion, even in Buddhism as well. So it's up to us to be questioning, rational, investigating. And actually, when you find the truth, it's a truth which transcends religions. So actually make friends with the genuine people of other religions, and the fraudsters, you know, you reject. What's the difference between an arahat and a bodhisattva? Please advise. If anyone knows what the bodhisattva precepts are on the six paramis, what you're supposed to practice on the bodhisattva path, what you're supposed to practice, three of those paramis are sila, samadhi and panya, virtue, meditation and wisdom. That's half of the path for a bodhisattva. In other words, the eightfold path. So you may think that they're different, but if you actually practice rather than just believing, they all lead to the same goal. As the Buddha said, anyone who practices that eightfold path, the Sila Samadhi Panya, it leads to full enlightenment. And there's no difference. I was just talking to Venerable Yifa. She's a Mahayana nun of the Fokwan Shan tradition. She's based in San Diego. It's a Taiwanese tradition, Mahayana. And the last time I talked to her, just after our conference,
And I was saying that, you know, that I'm so busy because not only do I go to Singapore and go to Malaysia and go around the world, but I've got so many disciples and monks and nuns under me in Perth. And she said to me, she said, "Oh, I don't like taking on disciples." And I said, "You Hinayana nun, you should be Mahayana like me. Because I take on disciples and I really give." And she said, "Yeah, you're more, Ajahn Brahm is more Ajahn Brahm is more Mahayana than I am." I'm supposed to be telling another. So what actually is the difference between Mahayana and Hinayana? It's only in the books and in the words, and when you actually you see people practicing, there's no difference there at all. Theravada monks are just so compassionate and kind, and they really work hard. Look at the chief reverend. How much did he give in his life? And there are Mahayana monks who spend time in solitude, and good for them, to develop deep meditation. So really there's no difference. We're all the same. We're in the same boat. We're all disciples of the Buddha. So remember what I said yesterday, no Hinayana, no Mahayana, Hahayana. Okay. How can we ask a person in coma on life support if he still wanted to live? Ask the question and listen in your heart. That's how you ask a question. Because when you ask the question with speech, you're also asking the question in your mind as well. And the mind has connections with other beings. You know intuitively what the other being wants. That's how you do it. You don't need to have psychic powers to intuit the feelings of another person. "Dear Ajahn Brahm, my marriage of 11 years broke down. I lost everything, including my four sons. I fell into a deep depression. It took me drugs and years of struggle to overcome the situation. My question is, if I have a strong basics of meditation before this incident happens, how does it work and what is the process of the mind that stabilizes our mental and emotional upheaval?" Usually, if you're more sensitive, the chances of such problems actually happening and getting to that stage are lessened. Because of your meditation, you are more sensitive and you see the problem coming before it gets to the point of no return. So the first thing to say is people who meditate have much more stable relationships because they solve the problems early. It's like, you know, when a tree is growing, when it's just a shoot, you can pull it out with your two fingers. When it's a huge monster of a tree, even bulldozers and dynamites have a hard time getting that tree out. But you've got to catch it early before the problem's too late and too big. So first of all, through meditation, you actually catch these problems earlier. But sometimes these things are karmic. Sometimes, despite you, these things break down. But at least you know that you don't blame yourself. In a separation, there's a lot of guilt there, even though you haven't done anything wrong. It's just nature. Too often people blame themselves. Think, if only I'd done this, I should have done that. And meditation helps you have kindness to yourself and let go of that guilt and that blame, which is 90% of the problem. And then meditation always understands this too will pass. Sure, it's disappointing to lose your children and your husband, but you know that's not forever. Children eventually make up their own mind and they want to come back to you, which eventually they do. And so you know it's only a temporary parting. And you also know that there are many other people out there in the world, and maybe you'll find another partner, again, which many people do. When you have the big picture which meditation gives you, you don't just focus, as I said the other day, on this hand which is too close to you. You put it out there as a problem, but there's more things happening in life. There's more future. So with meditation, actually you get the bigger picture. You put things in perspective. And it means you don't get so blown over by these tragedies of life. Become more able to withstand difficulties and disappointments. "Dear Ajahn, what a physical body, there really is nothing to be concerned about except for its craving." Oh, without a physical body. Does this sound right? Does it mean a light person's consciousness merges into the universe? Yeah, because you know you're not concerned about your body. You've had many bodies before, as I will tell you yesterday. Now you've got this one. It's getting older, but you aren't your body. It's a great, wonderful thing to know you're not your body, because then you don't have to have Botox when you get old. You can enjoy being old and ugly. In fact, there are many advantages to being ugly. When you really are ugly, you can have a bit of peace and quiet for men. This lady in Singapore came up to me, and she was a pretty girl. And she was complaining that she wanted to be single, and all these men were after her. I said, look, it's nature. Some girls would want to be pretty like you, and you've got pretty girls suffering instead of ugly girls suffering. And you know women, you know what it's like. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can we get enlightened by just understanding the Dhamma through book knowledge or Dhamma talks? If that was the case, many of you have read more books and all the professors will be enlightened, and all the Dhamma addicts who not just go to my talks but used to go to the Chief Reverend's talks and have got iPods and CDs, you'll be enlightened by now. No, you have to get enlightened through meditation. They say the three ways of practicing: pariyatti, which is study, patipatti, which is practice, and pativeda, means reflection. So, no, it is actually just for the practice of the path. That's the way to become enlightened. By practicing virtue, meditation, and getting insight, that's how you become enlightened. Not just by reading, but not without reading either. When practiced, why is it easier to observe the arising, but cessation is harder to observe? Because arising is when things are happening, like just people like to see young people, the beginning of things. When we build a new temple, people get very interested in coming to the new temple. When it's an old temple, we're not so interested. The only reason that people come to see Ajahn Brahm a lot, because I'm not here all the time. If I was here every day of the week, after a while you stop coming. It's when I arise in KL, then people are interested. But cessation, actually it's the same as well. When I come to KLIA airport, there's usually a lot of people come to greet me. But when I leave, there's not so many to send me off. It's true, because it's easier to observe arising, but not cessation. For example, when a person knows oneself is angry but unable to observe when angry cessation disappears, is it because the sati is not strong enough? It's harder to watch things fade away. But it's important actually to see. We actually learn to actually to watch things disappearing rather than things arising. There's more people who probably... This is actually when you arise into this world, when you get born. All your family members come around. And when a person is born, when they come out of the womb, they usually start crying. And everyone else is laughing with joy. But the baby cries. Perhaps the baby knows something you don't. And when you die, if you look at the dead person in the coffin, they're smiling. And everyone else is crying. We always get it the wrong way round. Dear Ajahn, is an arahat the Buddha? The Buddha was the first arahat of the sequence. That's the only difference. I was practicing a simple form of kasina. Kasina is actually watching a light. I know that somebody, when I said there was such a thing as kasino meditation, they thought, does that mean you go to the casino meditation? Trying to visualize a ball of light about 1 inch for a short period of time. If I did it for a few days, the back of my head began to have migraine. Is it a normal response? Why? The kasinas are a very powerful way of meditating, but they're not really for everybody, only for a select few. And if you do that focusing on an image of a light in your mind, too often that you try too hard, and people do get headaches because you're trying too hard. You need a very subtle mind to do kasina meditation, which is why it is very rarely taught. Breath meditation is much easier, more effective, you don't get headaches. So do the breath meditation instead of kasina. As a lay devotee, may I know what is the responsibility of lay supporters in the incident like the case in Kosambi Sutta? In the Kosambi, what happened there
a group of monks were arguing, and like most arguments, they started over a small about like cleaning the toilet. A tiny thing, and we argued about it. And how often do you argue about tiny things in your home, or in your temple, or in your office? So small things which create all the arguments. And this was what happened in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha heard there was a big argument in this monastery in India. He went to try and sort it out, but the monks were rude even to the Buddha, because when you're angry, you just forget who your teachers are and who your parents are. You forget everything when you're angry, you're crazy. And so the monks were rude to the Buddha. And so the Buddha said, okay, I'm going to go live by myself. The Buddha could not stop the argument. In the end, the lay people solved the argument. Because when they saw these monks were rude to the Buddha, and the Buddha left, so he couldn't give any talks, they met together, how can we teach these monks now to be respectful to our teacher the Buddha and to solve their arguments? So they had a meeting and they decided they would not give any food to the monks until they came to their senses. And so the monks went on arms round, they got nothing. No one brought any food to the monks. And after 7 days, the monks were so hungry, they met together, forgave each other, so they could eat again. And it worked in those days, you didn't support the bad monks. However, unfortunately, because monks have money these days, they don't need your support. They can go and just order something from the nearest restaurant. And that's the trouble with monks with money. With really good monks, you have full control over me. If you didn't come and give me breakfast in the morning, I'd be hungry. So if I said something this evening which offended you, let me know by not feeding me tomorrow. And that's actually what happened. Dear Ajahn, could you tell us something about Scientology started by Ron Hubbard? It is supposed to be based on Buddhism and has developed a method to get people enlightened fast. Your comments, please. For all I know of Scientology, it does seem to be really irrational, not really based on anything which is truthful. Like many things, it has a core of truth, but it has so much which is really a bit strange. And in particular, in the Scientology courses as I know them, you have to pay a lot of money. And any place where they sell truth for money doesn't make sense to me. Like, truth should be freely given. And they shouldn't charge people for it. You shouldn't say, okay, this is the first level, I'll give you that for free, but the second level you have to pay 1,000 ringgit. And for the next level, 2,000 ringgit. That's actually commodifying religion. And that sucks, as they say in the modern world. So any religion or any guru who charges you in that way, it's not right. And Ron Hubbard was supposed to be a science fiction writer. And so some of the stuff which he wrote about the meaning of world looks like straight out of science fiction. And any of these teachings, they should be open to question, open to debate, free, fair, open. And that has to be the case with all religions. Someone said some people are only suitable to be a lay devotee and not suitable to ordain. How will one know that she is suitable to ordain? As long as they are still breathing, they can ordain. In other words, we don't ordain corpses. I actually already have the conditions, factors to be ordained. Oh, you're alive, great. But I think I'm not suitable to ordain due to my heavy karma. One as a... Oh, I better not say what they've done. Do you want to know what they've done? No, they haven't actually. Due to heavy karma, not enough parami, not confident. I had ordained once as a 10th preceptor, but disrobed. Deep inside of me is very hunger for the holy life. Please give me advice. Because that I have been in this business a long time, I've seen many people become monks or nuns, and I think that's hopeless, they'll never get anywhere. But they have become amazing, wonderful teachers, wonderful monks and nuns. I can't tell whether you've got what it takes. I don't think you can tell either.
The best thing is to give it a try and see how it goes. And you'll soon find out by trying it out whether you've got what it takes. And sometimes you'll surprise yourself and all your friends. You make a great job as a monk or a nun. There's some people I thought would never make it, and they have. Some people I thought were born monks, born nuns, and they've left. I can't tell. Don't judge yourself so quickly. Dear Ajahn, do monks, say your disciples, have time to cultivate like the Buddha he gave after enlightenment? Wouldn't that be ideal? The Buddha gave after he was enlightened, but even after he became enlightened, he encouraged even unenlightened monks still to help out and to teach. Because when you are teaching, it's one of the ways people can become enlightened. Now, they've done their meditation, but sometimes when they're talking to others, they listen to what they say themselves, and sometimes they understand it deeper. So the Buddha actually said it was one of the duties of monks to teach. Not straight away when they just become ordained, but after they got their basic training. Don't wait till you become enlightened to teach. Teach what you know. Teach it honestly. And that was the advice of the Buddha. So you should be teaching, but still balance your teaching with your time to cultivate. And if it's well balanced, and I found this in practice, the monks who just stay by themselves in forests, in jungles, and never serve at all, they don't seem to get as far in their practice as those who balance their personal cultivation with service to the community. The ones who've got a good balance, they serve, but they also have special time for themselves, seem to have the fastest progress. How does one increase one's patience and tolerance? I'll just wait and patience will increase. If you haven't got any tolerance, just bear with it. In other words, patience and tolerance, loving kindness helps, wisdom helps, meditation obviously helps. Now, for those of you who look at my lifestyle, I have to be very tolerant, especially with you. No, you're wonderful disciples. And very patient. It's good fun being kind. Oh, does one need to die before achieving enlightenment? It's a bit of a waste to actually to die before you're enlightened. Get enlightened first and then die. Dear Bhante, Nibbana is the paramount sukha. That's actually good, because the word paramount is a Pali Sanskrit word. That's where we get the English word paramount from. Nibbana is the highest happiness. Sukha, like all phenomena, come and go. Can the search for Nibbana also lead to craving for happiness, which could also lead to dukkha? Yes, it can if you've got the wrong sort of happiness. The happiness of Nibbana is the happiness born of letting go. It's a freeing happiness, not an attaching happiness. And this is the thing I said a couple of days ago. The Buddha said, distinguish between the two different types of pleasure. There is the pleasure which is born of craving, attaching, owning, possessing. And there is the pleasure which is born of freedom, of letting go, of renouncing. Just when you don't want anything, and you've got this wonderful inner happiness. So that's a happiness which is not part of craving, and which leads to the end of suffering. So that's actually why the arahats feels happy. They don't just feel peaceful and calm. Arahats are the happiest beings. If you don't believe me, look in the Dhammacetiya Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. That's the one where I said King Prasenadi went to visit the Buddha and commented on how happy the monks were who were staying with the Buddha in the Jeta Grove Monastery. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what happens. You're happy when your meditation progresses and you become enlightened. Dear Ajahn, as Buddhism promotes compassionality, why does a Theravada monk not adopt vegetarian diet? Can we balance good karma or bad karma? Do you think it's possible for a layperson to achieve enlightenment? The Theravada monks, we are vegetarians and carnivores. We do both. The point is, we have to encourage vegetarian eating food, but sometimes that we allow meat eating as well. Especially, as I said, when I was a young monk in Thailand, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, and some of the things I ate as a young monk, I would have given so much to be a vegetarian again. The worst food I ever ate, or one of the worst foods, was not just the rotten fish. On one day, for our one meal of a day, we got a ball of sticky rice, and that day, no curries, all we got was a frog on top. Like a big frog, like a toad. And it was just boiled. Not fried, no sauces or seasonings, except a bit of salt. So frog on rice, so that was our one meal of the day. And if you think it's disgusting, you've had nothing yet. And when you have a frog, there's actually some meat on its legs. That's why the French have frog's legs. That's actually quite edible. But that's not enough to keep you going for the day. So after finishing off the small bit of meat on the frog's legs, we started, each one of us started to pick on the innards, the organs, to try and eat that. The monk sitting next to me did not know his biology. He pressed on the frog's bladder, and the bladder was still full of urine, and the frog peed all over his breakfast. That happened, that's true. We had some disgusting food. But we had to eat that because we're supposed to eat whatever we're given. And some people, that's just all they have. I tried to be a vegetarian in Perth many times. But sometimes Westerners, they give you what they eat. If they're vegetarian, they give you vegetarian food. If they're meat eaters, they give you meat food. So you have to eat whatever you're given. And that's our rule more than anything else, not to choose. Can we balance good karma over bad karma? Yes, you can dilute bad karma. As the Buddha said, that bad karma is like a spoonful of salt. If you put it in a glass of water, it makes a whole glass of water salty. That's when you've got bad karma and only a small amount of good karma. But the Buddha also said, if you take the same amount of salt and mix it in a swimming pool of water, then you can hardly tell the taste. Which means if you have some bad karma, you make lots and lots and lots of good karma, you actually dilute it. And that's actually how you can not get rid of bad karma, but you can dilute it. So those of you who've got bad karma, you better go diluting pretty soon. And do you think a lay person can achieve enlightenment? Yes, they can, they have, they did then, they do now. In the Kosambi Sutra, the last part, the two groups of monks came to unanimity. During the legal meeting, the lay people attend the meeting as well. That's an interesting one. I'm not quite sure if they attended the meeting. They can if the monks invite them, and they probably did. But the monks probably did it separately, then went to tell the lay people afterwards. They settled their differences. If yes, what is the role at the time? It's, I think the lay people actually were encouraging the monks to be good monks. Remember from that teaching that you all have a role to help the monks and the nuns be good monks and good nuns. So in Malaysia, you are important. So if you see a monk or a nun, sure, we sit on a high position when we give the talks. But we're human beings, talk to us, if there's things you don't like, give us feedback, so we can actually work together for the sake of religion in this country. Because sometimes we can have too much respect for our teachers, and sometimes because of too much respect and too much fear, the monks, the nuns, the teachers don't get feedback. And so that is bad for their practice and bad for the quality of the Sangha in Malaysia. So please give all your monks feedback. Do the monks, there's a lot of things about the monks in Kosambi. You must have been talking together today. There's the monks in Kosambi who cause lay people lost faith to anything to revive their faith. Yet when actually they settle their differences, doesn't that actually revive your faith? So even monks can have arguments, but we know how to solve our arguments. As I was saying earlier about my, where I grew up was a very small apartment. I saw my mother and father arguing. Because they were man and wife, they do argue from time to time. But I also saw my mother and father make up afterwards and forgive each other and hug and kiss. What I learned from that was arguments are part of life. We do have our differences. But I also saw how arguments and differences are settled. Because they never decided who was right and who was wrong. They decided, oh, let's forget about the argument. It's more important we love each other. And so they'd always make up in front of the children. And I remember that. And that's what I learned. It's all right to have disagreements and arguments as long as we remember to make up afterwards. So I think that's maybe what the lay people saw. They saw that, yeah, you can have disagreements in the Sangha, but we can also always resolve them. Goodness, it never ends, the questions. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I find that book-based beliefs religion is gaining a lot of converts simply because it discourages people from thinking and using logic. How to avoid such non-thinking process by these proselytizers? The only way to overcome, you know, stupid views is by making good views more clear and more prevalent, so you don't stop bad views by tearing them apart with negativity. The best way is actually having better examples and kinder examples. So they say it's getting a lot of converts, but I really don't think that's true. There's an old saying in Buddhism, it is the small streams which make all the noise. The big rivers flow silently. And those book-based religions, they make such a lot of noise, they are small streams. But the big rivers, now things like Buddhism, we flow silently. And we keep on growing. When I was in Malaysia 5 or 6 years ago, at a youth group, I asked the question, what's the fastest growing religion in the West? And all the kids said Christianity. So where did you hear that from? They said from the pastor. That's a lie. The truth is, and just check any of the statistics, these are government statistics done by secular governments, umpires, referees with no axe to grind. Buddhism is usually the fastest growing religion in most Western countries. And the children were surprised to hear that. And so sometimes that some people, they say that we're growing really fast to get more converts, but it's not the truth. Some of those religions, as one of my Christian friends, who's one of the mainstream Christians, an Anglican, not one of these proselytizing evangelicals, but one of the mainstream Anglicans, he calls it the revolving door church. Many people go in, but many people leave. And the reason is because there's nothing there to keep them. All the promises are usually empty promises, and they find that out by experience. And that's happening, always happens in the West. They get a lot of people going in, but a lot of people leaving as well. Simply because there's nothing there. And make many promises. If you join this church or this congregation, you become rich, famous, whatever, or your cancers will be healed. But they don't. And so people actually leave when they realize, hey, it doesn't work. An enlightened being will give everything to care for others, even at the expense of their own health and spirit. But if they can't even care for themselves, how can they help others? Is that enlightenment? Is it just my attachment that disturbs me? Thank you. Again, an enlightened being sees no difference between themselves and others. Remember what I said in the relationship, it's not me, it's not them, it's us. So an enlightened being always sees it as us. It's not me, it's not you, it's always us. So there's no difference between me and the other. So that's an enlightened being. So you care for everybody, you included. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my mother has been in a nursing home, in a hospital, the home for more than 2 years. The home is attached to a hospital. She sees a neurosurgeon and is mentally alert. She cannot walk and moves in a wheelchair. She also has heart trouble. She lies on a bed the whole day. I have seen her teetering on the brink of death and then bouncing back more than a dozen times. Now that happened to me once. That I was visiting someone who was about to die. Their family had invited me to just give them some chanting. So I went in there and I gave them some very, very powerful chanting. And they started getting better. And the family were very upset at me. And they said, look, we're ready to die, now you've cured her. So I was very careful next time to do a different type of chanting. To me, she is clearly on a life support system delivered via medicine. She has lost her independence and with that also her rights. She has rights but cannot exercise them because she has lost her independence. My sister goes with her to see her neurosurgeon and makes all the decisions for her. My mother is 91 years old. Thank you very much. What does it say here? Do you think that she should tell her doctor that she wants to discontinue her medicine? It's very difficult when you try and make a decision for a 91-year-old. Obviously, if that 91-year-old makes her own decision that she wants to withdraw treatment, that is an option which is allowed in Western countries. I'm not sure whether it's legally allowable here in Malaysia or Singapore, but many times people have what they call living wills, where when they're still in their full capacity, that they make a decision, they write it down with a lawyer, and they say that in the case that I am on a life support system with no quality of life or whatever, you can take away all artificial means of support and let nature take its course. That is my will. And that becomes obligatory for the relations and the doctors to follow that patient's orders. Because they make a decision. In today's world, is it really killing or is it just allowing nature, the natural course of life and death to happen? It's a difficult decision, and there is a difference there between killing people and actually just letting nature take its course. And taking away the artificial means of support and just letting nature work. But sometimes people actually take away the food and the water. And that's not letting nature take its course. That's starving a person or depriving them of their fluids. So, but if it's just turning off the respirator or whatever, then that seems to be just letting nature take its course. So please see the difference there. And it really should be your 91-year-old mother's decision, and not the daughter, not your sister's. And sometimes if the 91-year-old seems to be incapacitated, they cannot speak, or they seem to be mentally out of it, you can still do what I call asking them and actually hearing the answer in your heart, what your mother wants. And I would trust that. I'm not going to finish the questions today. Again, I'll leave these for tomorrow. I'll do two more. And please, can I ask anyone who asks the questions, only one question per person, please. So it gives a chance for other people to ask questions. And also, your question, one question, has to be just a single question, not part A, part B, part C. So that tomorrow we can finish off the questions. But the last two questions here today, marriage is hard work as it is. Do you have any basic of advice for couples who have an interfaith marriage? For example, a Christian husband and a Buddhist wife. And how should the couple teach their children about religion and God? Once one of my friends, a monk in England, was asked a similar question by some parents. And actually the parents were Western Buddhists. They said, how should we teach our children? Should I teach our children to be Buddhists and take them to temples, or should I let them find their own way, or should I take them to a church, a mosque, a temple, a synagogue, so they can find out about all religions? Help! How should we help our children? And the monk gave one of the most beautiful answers I've heard. He said, you don't need to take your child to any church or temple, but please encourage your child to be strong in two ways. First, encourage them to always ask questions. And second, encourage them to be honest. And with those two abilities of questioning and honesty, you will be equipping your child to find their own path in life. And to be able to question the religions and the philosophies which are in the marketplaces of temples and religions in our modern world. You'll be equipping them to investigate, to challenge, to question, so any false teachings they will soon uncover. And they'll be honest enough never to stop until they get an answer which is accorded with logic, reality, experience. And that goes for you too. Always question and be honest. Be honest to truths, to the experience of your life. And if anything you hear, whether it's from me or any other sifu or any other priest or philosopher or expert, if anything you hear doesn't make sense, don't accept it. But question and be honest. And with questioning and honesty, you are equipping your child to find out the reality at the heart of each religion. And that's something which transcends this or that religion. So when you do that, you're actually equipping your kid to find the truth, and you're finding the truth yourself. And also you can find a wonderful marriage between the Buddhist and the Christian. Why do I cry when I meditate? Is that good or is that bad? The reason why you cry is because that's the last question for this evening. And now you have to go home. Oh, how sad that is. So thank you for coming today about enlightenment and all sorts of other business on the way. So, apparently I was told today that there were some very bad floods in Johor and other places. So it would be a wonderful thing today to do the spreading of, or sharing of merits. But apparently we don't know actually how many people lost their lives in the floods. They were quite severe, I was told. So when we're doing the sharing of merits now, it's not just for your departed relations, it's for all those people who may have lost their lives in the floods in the southern part of this peninsula. So please chant with me with full sincerity. Idam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you very much, and I apologize for the microphone, and sometimes it cuts out. Hope you heard most of it. Have a nice evening and maybe see you tomorrow. May you all come for the reincarnation talk, or if you die in the evening or tomorrow morning, may you please come here and be reincarnated as a ghost to listen to the next talk.